Welcome back to the program. Many novelists and playwrights are simply keen observers of the world around them. They watch, they feel, they think, they create and aggregate stories. But for some, think Fitzgerald, Hemingway, and so many others, they themselves embody their work and their time. There is a kind of almost impenetrable membrane between them and the stories and characters that they create. Wendy Wasserstein, author of such plays as The Heidi Chronicles and The Sister Rosenzweig, was such a writer. She captured the essence of the post-feminist angst of the 80s and gave voice to so many women who felt that she knew them, and she certainly touched them. She was the winner of the Pulitzer Prize and the first woman playwright to win a Tony Award, and her untimely death at the age of 55 short-circuited an incredible talent. We're going to talk about Wendy Wasserstein today with a guest that has been with us many times before. She is Julie Solomon. Julie is a former film critic for the Wall Street Journal, the author of numerous award-winning books, including Hospital, Facing the Wind, and The Devil's Candy. She's a graduate of Tufts University and New York University Law School. It is my pleasure to welcome Julie Solomon back to this program to talk about her new biography, Wendy and the Lost Boys, The Uncommon Life of Wendy Wasserstein. Julie Solomon, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me, Jeff. It's great. A pleasure.
Great to have you here. Wendy really was, she really embodied kind of baby boomer culture of the time. I mean, she was born in 1950, grew up in New York, really sort of captured the essence of what it was like being a baby boomer.
She really did, and it's been absolutely remarkable. I'm going around the country now talking about the book, and the audiences that show up, even though they're not all baby boomers, I've been gratified that there have been young people in the audience as well, but for the baby boomers, especially women, I can't tell you how many people come up to me and say, I knew Wendy, and then I say, how did you know her? And they say, well, I didn't know her personally, but they felt as though she was a really smart friend of theirs that helped explain the world to them.
Talk a little bit about how she grew up, how she started to see the world. She had very, very demanding parents, and really all of her siblings were overachievers.
Well, it's true, and I think one of the most important things to know about Wendy Wasserstein is that she was, yes, a baby boomer, but she was also the daughter of immigrants. Her parents both came to this country well before World War II as very young people, and they really had nothing. And they became successful. It's the old-fashioned American success story that sadly now feels like something from another era. But the parents were successful, and then Wendy's oldest sister, who was 13 years older than her, became a very successful businesswoman, one of the top executives at American Express and then Citibank. And her older brother, Bruce Wasserstein, became a billionaire investment banker. So she had an extraordinary family.
There was also a kind of immigrant experience within the culture when the family moved from Brooklyn to Manhattan.
Well, that's right. I mean, a part of it was moving up, and one thing that was very, very noticeable about the family, and I think the thing that probably affected Wendy's work more than anything else, like many immigrant families, the Wasserstein were very secretive, or they seemed secretive to their children. I think a lot of what was perceived of as secrecy was just not wanting to talk about a lot of extreme hardships that the family had gone through. And I think the secrecy, Wendy used to say that her parents would say that when somebody died, if somebody in the family died, they would tell the kids, oh, they went to Europe. So there was this attitude that life had to move on, you had to forge ahead, but I think it left a lot of scars. And Wendy took those scars and turned them into works of art.
The other aspect of it that is so interesting with her was the way in which, as you said at the outset, people seemed to know her. She was so revealing about herself, so many things about her that were embodied in her work. And yet at the same time, she was really a very private person.
She was, and that's really what made me so interested in doing the book, because about a year after she died, Frank Rich, who had been the theater critic at the Times and then a columnist and was a close friend of Wendy's, wrote an appreciation of her life. And he said in that article that here was this person who seemed to be the most open a public figure in New York. She wrote about giving birth to her daughter at age 48 as a single mother. She wrote about her boyfriends, her manicures, her, you know, her dreams and her disappointments. And yet, he said, after she died, what struck so many of the people who were very closest to her was how much they didn't know. And that was just fascinating to me. And so writing the book became almost like uncovering a mystery story.
She also compartmentalized her life. She was revealing, but she only let certain people know certain things, but it made them feel as if they were in on everything.
Well, that's exactly right, and that was another thing. You know, I did almost 300 interviews for the book, because, and I would say out of those 300 interviews, 200 of them were with people who said, oh, I was Wendy's best friend. And it's exactly as you're describing, and I think that what made all these people think that Wendy had such a close access to her was that she actually listened to them. So she was one of those people who really listen, and at the end of a two-hour discussion where the one person does all the talking, they say to the person listening, oh, you're such a good conversationalist. And I think she really made people feel that their stories were very important. And then they felt so even more, because many times they would see stories they told her or their personalities reflected in her characters.
The other aspect of her that is so contradictory, and I think one of the most fascinating parts, is this sense of being both an insider and an outsider. She was very much part of that world of theater and of the whole scene in New York in the 70s and 80s and 90s, and yet she felt herself as an outsider at the same time, as somebody with their nose pressed against the glass.
I think that's right, and I think part of that is also, I think, not uncommon among people who are children of immigrants. And I think for that baby boom generation, especially the ambitious group who were really often the first children to go to college, the first to succeed, even though they became wealthy and they became well-known, there was a little bit of that Stella Dallas thing of pressing the nose at the window. And she wrote about this phenomenon of superior-inferior. In the Heidi Chronicles, there's a point where the heroine talks about how she felt better than everybody else, but also inferior to them. And I think that really reflected Wendy's own feelings.
Talk about her views in terms of women and the women's movement, which she captured so well in so much of her work, particularly the Heidi Chronicles, but in others as well.
I think one of the things that really placed Wendy on the map was the first play she wrote, which was Uncommon Women and Others, and it was about her experience at Mount Holyoke College. She was there between 1967 and 1971, and I think that was hugely, hugely important in her development, because when she entered the college, the young women were girls, and they were treated very paternalistically. They had to dress for dinner. It was a very cloistered atmosphere, and in those 4 years, there were huge social changes throughout the country, and by the time, you know, there was a story one of the women told me that when she entered college, the women were gathered in the gym and told to take up for sports golf and tennis because it would be good for their husbands' careers. And by the time they graduated 4 years later, they were told that they should be the ones who are the doctors and lawyers and heads of corporations. So it was a huge shift in the culture. And I think for Wendy and a lot of women, it became very confusing because it created all these dilemmas, which will always face women, I think, is how to balance a family and a career. Those are questions for men as well, but I think women feel them much more profoundly.
And partly because she was such an outsider in so many ways, even within that Mount Holyoke environment, that she was this, you know, from Jewish immigrant parents and didn't fit in completely, that was really the beginning of this outsider-insider view of the world.
I think that's right, and I think, you know, I think many, many writers and artists come from this outsider group because nobody observes better than somebody who is very interested in what's going on inside. And I think that was something that plagued her throughout her life. She both benefited from that feeling of being an outsider, but I think it was also very painful for her.
Talk about what her experience was like when she went to Yale Drama School, where she really had a group of friends, so many of whom became famous: Meryl Streep, Sigourney Weaver, Christopher Durang, etc.
Well, Yale Drama School is another example of the superior inferior, because when she went there, there were only a handful of women at Yale outside of the actors. There were very few playwrights who were women at that time. This was in the mid-70s. There were very few set designers who were women. Most of those jobs men were being trained for. And Bob Brustein, who was the head of Yale Drama at that time, had very little interest in Wendy's work. He dismissed her as domestic comedies. And so there was a very poignant moment when she was graduating from Yale and the class wasn't very big. And almost every single person was being called up, not just to receive one honor, but two or three. And Wendy received none.
How did she respond to that?
She responded the way she always did, and that's one of the things that I really loved about her story. She picked herself up and dusted herself off and forged ahead. And after Yale Drama School, she had started working on Uncommon Women while she was at Yale Drama, and she just kept working on it. And she had many people who liked her work. And the other thing that was really great about Wendy is she knew how to use people in a positive way. So she was always good at finding people who were really talented and really interested in her work and letting them help her, criticize her work. She took criticism well. She was anything but a diva.
She was also very good at friendship. I mean, she had sort of mastered that.
She really did. I mean, she was a really good friend. I mean, I spent a lot of time in the archive at Mount Holyoke where she donated her papers. And there are so many notes and letters from her friends, and actually many of them that Wendy wrote to other people that I guess people must have donated to the archive. And there's a lot of caring in them. And she always found the perfect little gift that would make somebody feel really special. She always took time to write a note. There was a great moment when an actress had tried out for a role in one of her plays, and she was very good, and Wendy had become friends with her, but she didn't get the part. And Wendy wrote her a long letter explaining that the part had really been designed for another actress previous to this workshop. And the actress, Carolyn Aaron, said to me, in her entire life in show business, nobody had ever taken the time to write something thoughtful like that, that appreciated that she had feelings.
She also had this great power, you alluded to it before, this great power of observation and memory. I mean, she watched things happen, and she would remember them, even from things in her youth.
It was incredible. In fact, one of the most remarkable pieces of work of hers that I found in the Mount Holyoke archive was a play that she wrote very near the end of her life when she was quite sick. And it was only produced briefly in a workshop for a week, so it's never really been produced. And it was called Welcome to My Rash. And it's essentially a two-person play between a patient who's a middle-aged woman who has a very serious disease and her doctor. And it's a really remarkable play, and I took it to Wendy's oncologist, who had never read it, and he read the play, and he was astonished, and he said to me, "This play is verbatim conversations that I had with Wendy over the course of her treatment." He was blown away by it, at how accurate it was, and his reaction I heard over and over and over again from people who saw themselves in various characters that Wendy wrote.
She also had this ability to kind of presage her own future within the context of her plays.
It's true. And in some ways, you know, I couldn't tell if she was forecasting the future or kind of mapping it out for herself. You know, so at the end of Isn't It Romantic, which was the second play she wrote that was a big off-Broadway hit, and it's about a young woman in her 20s trying to decide what her path should be. Would she have a career or would she get married? And at the end of the play, she breaks up with the nice young man she was living with, and the end of the play has the heroine dancing alone. Well, that exact thing happened to Wendy in her own life. And then in the Heidi Chronicles, at the end of the play, the heroine Heidi Holland is a successful art historian who is alone, and at the end of the play, she decides to adopt a baby. And Wendy, in her own life, went ahead in her late 40s and gave birth to her own child. And so over and over again, it felt like she was either forecasting or figuring it out through her writing.
Unfortunately, the same wasn't true for Third.
No, unfortunately, the same was not true for Third. That was her last play. And again, an extraordinary feat. She worked on that play the last year of her life when she was unbelievably ill. And in the course of that year, she did more than most people do in the prime of their youth. She finished that play, which was produced to a sold-out engagement in Lincoln Center. She had a young child at that point. She wrote most of her last novel, the final draft, which was eventually published after she died. She wrote many articles, and she traveled around the country doing speaking engagements and taught at Dartmouth. I mean, it was, and this was while she was dying.
The other parts of the endings of her play is that there was always a sense of uncertainty, a sense of not really being sure what was going to happen next.
When I think, again, going back to the family secrets, without giving away all the good parts
right.
of the book, but there was a brother in her family who was kept apart from the other children, who Wendy didn't know about growing up, or she knew that he existed, but she didn't meet him until she was almost 50 years old. And she found out when she was in her 20s that her older two siblings had a different father than she did. And this was something that, you know, so I think that she, through these secrets and this cover-up of the family, whether deliberate or not deliberate, I think she always had a hard time trusting the reality around her. She never knew quite what was real and what wasn't.
Talk about her relationships with men, particularly this large group of gay men that she had friendships with that she often referred to as her husbands.
Right. Well, you know, what happened was when Wendy was younger, she had a couple of serious relationships with straight men that were, you know, that were relationships that looked like they were leading towards a longer-term relationship, either marriage or children, you know, a more traditional trajectory. But she always felt that, I think, she was always afraid that if she settled down, in quotes, the way her mother would have liked her to, that she would lose her creative urge. And I think that her attraction to the gay men of the theater began at Yale when she met Christopher Durang, who is adorable. I mean, I totally understand why this happened for you. He's brilliant, he's attractive, he's charming, and he was so nice to her and so supportive and so wonderful. And so I think that it was a relationship that was very appealing. And Wendy once wrote, the other piece of the puzzle was that her older brother Bruce and she had an incredibly close relationship when she was younger. And I think these sort of brotherly relationships made her feel very much at home.
That relationship with her brother Bruce had its ups and downs over the years as well.
Big ups and downs because, you know, when I started working on the book, I met somebody who was a Wall Street guy, and he asked what I was working on. I said, I'm doing a biography of Wendy Wasserstein. And so he said, well, the one thing I want you to figure out is how did the same DNA produce Bruce Wasserstein and Wendy Wasserstein? Because Bruce was known as a ruthless banker who was a tough, tough deal maker, who was kind of arrogant, who, if Wendy was the best listener in the world, he seemed not to be at all interested. And yet, they were very similar in other ways. They were both incredibly ambitious. They knew how to use their connections to get ahead. And I think the thing that was their biggest bond was the fact they both were incredibly close to their families. Even if the family that Wendy was born into drove her crazy, it was also a big source of comfort for her. And so they did have a fractious relationship. I mean, Wendy never married. Bruce married four times. And so I think they were living lives that were parallel but quite different.
But in many ways, the clarity of that similarity is pretty powerful. I mean, there was, for both of them, and just exhibited in very different ways, there was this, again, the inside-outside, the sense of alienation, the sense of something to prove.
Right, and we can't forget to talk about Lola, Wendy's
right.
mother, who was... You know, when Lola was sort of the Jewish mother on steroids, you know, she was just as tough as could be. I mean, I think she loved her children mightily, but there was nothing they could do that was quite good enough. And that's pretty debilitating.
Talk a little bit about her daughter that she had at 48 years old.
Well, Lucy Jane... Wendy actually started doing a tremendous number of fertility treatments throughout her 40s in an attempt to have a baby. She had finally decided if she wasn't going to have a traditional marriage, she was going to have a child. And so finally, when she was 48, she became pregnant, and the pregnancy lasted, and she gave birth to Lucy Jane Wasserstein in 1999. And I think one of the most well-known pieces of writing that she did, judging from the people who have talked to me about it subsequently, was just a few months after she gave birth to Lucy Jane, she wrote an incredible article in The New Yorker detailing the events that led up to Lucy Jane's birth. It's a beautiful piece. It's filled with detail. It's emotional. It's evocative. And it's only half true. And it was like a lot of Wendy's nonfiction writing. She wrote the story that she wanted people to believe. This was her life story, but she had a certain way she wanted it viewed and she wanted it interpreted.
How did she reconcile that with what she perceived also as her honesty as a writer?
Well, you know, it's an interesting story. I think that... honesty as a writer is a fascinating subject, and with Wendy it was particularly complicated because in her fiction, in her plays, I think she told profound truths. And in her nonfiction, I think she told the truth she went, it was more fictionalized. It was the truth the way she wanted it to be told. I think she wanted things wrapped up in a happier ending.
The degree to which so many women felt that they knew her, that whose lives were touched by her, talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think there were the people who knew her who felt, I think that because Wendy was not the person who, when she was 8 years old, everybody pointed at her and said, oh, she's going to be president of the United States or she's going to be a great writer. They looked at her and said, oh, Wendy's such a mess. And that kind of continued all through college, that she was the person who teachers would write on her paper, you're obviously very bright, but you're not living up to your potential. And so I think just... the most basic level, I think the fact that somebody who was the imperfect one and the kind of scatterbrained one seemed like from the outside, the disheveled one, pulled herself together and became a huge success. I think that was something that made people happy for her and also hopeful for themselves. If Wendy could do it, maybe I could do it. So there's that. But I think on the other hand, even more, was that because she was interested in the human condition, because she was such a close observer, she really paid attention to people when she was with them. She had a way of making the person she was talking to feel like the most important person in the room. And that's a rare gift. And so I think that's why people felt the loss. And then the people who didn't know her personally, I think her writing was just very accessible. She was funny, she was witty, and she worried about the thing. She was a New York intellectual, and yet she said she worried about getting a manicure. She worried about her inability to lose weight. She also couldn't find a boyfriend. She was real. So even though she was part of this glamorous world, she was like the woman next door.
Was she lonely?
Well... you know, I think she was and she wasn't. You know, she had an almost frantic social life, which some people interpreted as a fear of being by herself, a fear of loneliness. And I wonder if almost every writer isn't at heart somewhat lonely, because she created, lonely in the real world, but comfortable in the world that she created. So, you know, at the end of her life, she was surrounded by a lot of people who loved her. But I do think there was some core of herself that she never let anybody see or let anybody share.
How important was New York to her? It doesn't necessarily come out as much in her plays as it does perhaps in her novel Elements of Style.
I think that's right, and in her essays. You know, when she died, the New York Times ran it was an article in the art section called Wendy's Wasserstein's New York. And she, over the years, had written an incredible number of just little essays at different times of years about different aspects of New York that she loved. You know, Central Park, the landmarks, Central Park, Rockefeller Center, all of those things were hugely important to her. And New York City, especially in her essays, is one of her main characters.
Talk a little bit about this sense, again, coming back to her plays and the ending of the plays and what we were talking about before. Her characters always wind up alone at the end of the plays.
They always wind up alone, and I think that reflected Wendy's reality. I mean, even after she had Lucy Jane, sadly, she died way, way before her daughter. I mean, her little girl was only 5 or 6 years old when Wendy died. And so, and she kept her illness so private. She really let only a few people into to become aware of how ill she was, only at the very, very end. And that, to me, was incredibly sad. But it was also a family tradition. Her older sister had done the same when she died of cancer. Her brother Bruce, who died after Wendy a couple of years later, also kept his illnesses very, very private. So they were the opposite of the current culture. You know, they were definitely not reveal all. And I think it took its toll.
Talk a little bit about the daughter, because there was this incredible series of events that happened over a period of years, but all too quickly. Lucy Jane was born in 1999, and then Wendy died in 2006. She comes ill in 2001. The baby goes to live with the brother, Bruce, who dies in 2009.
Right. It was absolutely heartbreaking, actually. I mean, writing the end of the book was extremely difficult. I mean, I felt so tied to this woman and her family and her life, and so interested in it every moment of the way. And then the ending was like it was really Shakespearean. It was so tragic. And the guardian for Lucy Jane was Pam Wasserstein, who was Bruce's oldest child. At the time Wendy was in her final stages of life, Pam was still a young woman. She was single, and I think at that point Wendy realized she had to make another arrangement, for the short term at least. And so she asked Bruce and his third wife, Claude, who had children about the same age as Lucy Jane, if they would take Lucy Jane, and they agreed. And so they took Lucy Jane, and then they subsequently divorced, and so the three kids were in a joint custody arrangement. And then Bruce died, so now Lucy Jane is with Claude and with her brothers, who are her cousins, just as Wendy grew up with siblings who were her siblings but also her cousins, because Lola's first husband was the brother of Wendy's father. So the family relationships have always been complicated and continue to be.
Julie Salomon, the book is Wendy and the Lost Boys, The Uncommon Life of Wendy Wasserstein. Julie, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you.